Welcome, everybody, to episode 57 of Underserved. Today with me in studio, I have Eric Dask, Vice President of Engineering at FormAssembly. Let's get going.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Welcome, Eric. Thank you so much for coming down to join us on Underserved.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Really looking forward to it.
Now, originally, I think you were born in France. Your dad was a film director. What was that like?
That's right. I was born into, I think, something special. We moved to the south of France when I was just a baby, and I was raised in a very kind of secluded part of France, very unpopulated part of France, but a very beautiful one. My dad was, a director, so I was born into that interesting business and, you know, decided to kind of follow it in his footsteps in a sense, in that to him, there wasn't really a week and a weekend. There was just doing what he wanted to do. And to me, I really wanted to go to work on Monday and not have it feel like it was a job, but have it feel like I wanted to be there. And it was Monday morning and I was excited and I wanted it to last throughout the week. And I think that's something I inherited from my dad, the pleasure of doing something that I love.
Now, on the pre-call, you described it as the West Virginia of France.
Yeah, a friend of mine was a tech guy as well. Sam Clements describes it as such, which is not false. I think it's the way I've never been to West Virginia, but, you know, I think of it as beautiful and remote and many hills and, you know, kind of down-to-earth people, I guess.
Well, I've only been to Marseille, but I can say that was definitely beautiful.
It is. Yeah, really is.
So what got you interested in technology? When did you first touch computers?
That's an interesting story, I think. So like many kids of my generation born in the early 70s, I got a taste of the very early video games. I had a Mattel Intellivision console and got that because Mattel had the pretense at the time that a computer could basically slide into that console. I don't know if I tricked my parents or they thought it was the right thing to do to buy me something that would extend to being more than a game console. Of course, Mattel never delivered on that. But one day, my mom was listening to a radio show where essentially people would ask on the radio show for things they wanted. You know, I'm not really sure what they were asking for. I know what I asked for was a computer to learn how to use computers over the summer. I must have been maybe 10 or 11 or something like that. And someone did reply. I remember his name was Mr. Pinson, and I don't remember where he was in France, but I ended up with a very large one-block keyboard, small monitor, main unit, CBM from Commodore, which was essentially the evolution of the PET. And it was definitely a professional computer, not a home computer. And so I had that, and I think it came with a book about BASIC. And I would type in the listings and, you know, run them. And it was great. Like I was able to experience that. And I remember at dinner one time, we had people over that played tennis with my dad and we're from a nearby factory and we're probably in technical drawing and things like that. And one of them said to me, you know, you don't have to just copy these things. You can actually learn how to program and do your own thing. And I was flabbergasted. I mean, it was a huge revelation for me. And I would guess that was my introduction to programming, right? So I learned how to use BASIC. I remember getting really interested in Forth, the fourth language, maybe because I had an incline towards mathematics. And so I used that computer for the summer, eventually got a Commodore 64 and kind of the rest is history. But I, early on in high school, before this was offered, most of the two people got into a programming class. And then in college, when I decided what I wanted to do, and then when it was time for me to decide what I wanted to do for college, I had two passions. One of them was computer software and the other was astronomy, mostly observing things rather than really astrophysics. And then I kind of inquired about that career path and learned that in France, you basically have 5 new jobs a year in astronomy when 5 people retire every year, right? So
in the whole country.
In the whole country and mostly in an academic type setting. So I decided, that's got to be too hard. I'm not going to do this. Obviously, computer software at the time was interesting, but not the huge job provider than it is today, right? Not the great career that has become today. But I decided to go do that and found my way through college into computer science engineering school. And
yeah, now I think you said that in France, it's kind of traditional. If you want to get into a good engineering school, you got to first go to a prep school. What was that like?
You know, France, just like every country, is a different system, right? And I have to be careful because prep school here sounds very preppy, right? And something I'm not clear on what it is in the US. It's either where you go when you're not good enough or when you go into a private school or whatever. You prep school in France is very different. It's to prepare you to a national contest where you get ranked, and based on that ranking, you get matched with a school, right? So it's essentially 2 to 3 years. You could double up the second year. So 2 to 3 years of intense math, physics, a little bit of English, technical drawing, chemistry, but mostly math and physics. And I don't remember what it is, but you end up doing something like 40 hours a week of math. That's just math, right? And then every week you have an oral exam, and every 2 weeks you have a written exam. And every time you have an exam, you're given a sheet that gives you your grade, your ranking in the class for that grade, how that grade affects your total ranking in math, say, and how that rank affects your total ranking in the school. So every 2 weeks, you know exactly where you're standing, right? Luckily enough and quickly enough, I found myself doing pretty well and going into an engineer school that was very focused on kind of practical learning, which was very different from the other schools in France. And I think something that really defined me later on made it mandatory that we'd go through 3 work internships of 6 months that in the Northeast we tend to call co-ops, right? And that really made me successful early on in many ways, because when I graduated school, I already had 18 months of experience, right? And so I went straight from my third co-op to my first job without skipping a beat, basically doing the same thing I was doing in my co-op and starting to do it as a full-time employee. And I think that's a unique approach that I tend to favor when hiring young engineers.
Now, is this the time you became interested in Next Computers, the company that Steve Jobs had brought about?
Yeah. So in prep school, we had a few different computers, and some of them were the old black and white workstations, the Next stations from Next. So I don't remember if it was my first or second internship. I decided, hey, I'm just going to email Steve Jobs, right? steve@next.com, and see what happens. Turns out he didn't reply directly, but he received it, forwarded it to his guy in Europe, who forwarded it to another guy who was looking to do some business in Russia and was based out of Houston, Texas. Talked to the guy. He offered me a job. I was supposed to, the June of that year, go to Houston to start that 6 months internship. And maybe a month before, he called me up and say, change plans. I'm moving to Moscow. And if you want, you can come here as well. And I'm going to build a company there. So I did. It was June 28th, landing in Moscow that year. It was the early 90s, probably 92, something like that. And I remember some random person picked me up at the airport. I remember what gave me a quick introduction to Russia at the time. The guy would shut off his car every time it show up at a traffic light, only to start it again. And I thought, wow, that seems really inconvenient, and I'm not sure he's saving a lot of fuel. But what's funny is that today most ICE cars do that, right? They'll shut off at the light and start again, which is still very unsettling. But yeah, I had a great time in Russia, and we built software there. So I was in charge of a small team of chemical engineers from the Moscow Institute of Chemistry that built a 3D visualization software for molecules, so molecules in 3D on behalf of that company. So it was kind of my first engineering leadership gig. I was probably 19 at the time, or 18 or something like that. It was really interesting. It was crazy time in Moscow. My boss was crazy. What we did was a little crazy. He was into a lot of different things, including night vision equipment, importing into the US. It's just a job that was kind of more of an octopus than a job, because it was going in every direction in a chaotic but really interesting fashion.
Well, it kind of makes sense. Like, night vision is quasi-military, quasi-munitions, and weren't NeXT computers considered munitions at the time?
They were. That's a good point. So it was at a time where you could not export strong encryption, and NeXT computer, just like Silicon Graphic computers at the time, which we looked into as well, were considered essentially weapons, right? And you could not import them into Russia without a lot of paperwork, which we did. But I remember there's prescription now. It's been over 25 years, probably. But I remember like coming into Moscow as I occasionally travel back and forth with a cart full of workstations. And they were all legal, but probably coming through them, through the airport as a passenger with them, probably wasn't as legal. But at the time, there were a lot of weird things happening in Moscow anyway.
Huh.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
So after that, do you make your way to the States?
Not directly. I mean, I do graduate, obviously, go back to school after that, graduate, and then start working for a consulting company there where I did my last co-op. Within the offices of this company, a couple people and we say, hey, let's open the French office for this startup called Silverstream based out of Burlington, Massachusetts. I mean, that was a phenomenal time in my career. Got to travel here for work, got to meet a lot of great people. We went through an IPO, I think summer of 1999. And then towards the end of the year, they reach out to me from the U.S. office and say, listen, we'd love you to come to the U.S. It was Charlie Ungashick I had a chance to work with three times in my career. And Charlie gave me a job twice, once then and once at Novell, after Silverstream, which I had joined the U.S. office of in early 2000, got acquired by Novell around probably 2003 or so. And that was such a great experience. I was product manager for those years until the acquisition by Novell, and then a few years after that.
At Novell, you got to work with Mono, right? The .NET on Linux?
I did, exactly. Yeah, that's actually when Charlie brought me in into that other division within Novell. He had left Silverstream himself and then came back to go work for Novell. That was really interesting as well. Still a product manager there. Not just my first taste, but my first bath of open source, right? I mean, you usually get it little by little. Yeah, I was thrown into probably one of the major open source projects in terms of its impact. Obviously, less public than something like Firefox or Chromium or others, but in the background, just Mono has had a lot of great impact on the industry, right? Later on, got spun off by Novell into Xamarin, and then Xamarin got acquired by Microsoft, and then Nate went on to GitHub, I think.
So Mono was a open source version of the .NET runtime, libraries, everything that was kind of like a white box re-implementation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was basically the idea was that .NET was just a really good idea, but a very proprietary one that only ran on Windows. It was Java only at the time. .NET was going to be multi-language from the get-go, right? They had to support Visual Basic with VB.NET, C#, and other languages like F# and others came along. So it was a great idea to be able to run it from anything, and it really did, from basically microcontrollers almost to mainframes, right? Because the SUSE people, which Novell had acquired, really insisted that everything they distributed had to run on everything they supported. So Mono had to run the whole gamut.
Now, with any open source project and with you being kind of the person figuring out, all right, whose stuff gets in, whose doesn't, did you have any problems with contributors?
We had some really fun things happening. I mean, open source at that scale is really, really drama central. So you have to be prepared for everything. So as part of .NET, there is ASP.NET, right? And ASP.NET is their basically web building library. So we focused on that as well as the desktop experience and many other things. And obviously a lot of people that were contributing to Mono at the time were employees of Novell. There were also, because it was a large open source project, a lot of contributors from everywhere, right? So there was this guy that worked for Novell and was the main contributor to ASP.NET, but he took contributions from other people that made it into the code source, the source code, sorry. And one day we realized that this guy from the Middle East had been contributing to ASP.NET pretty heavily. And we realized that what we had done was essentially decompile the existing Microsoft code for ASP.NET and basically changed a few things and then committed that code.
The old decompile, recompile.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we did a lot of reverse engineering and looking at docs and et cetera to understand how .NET worked, but that was a big no-no. And the way this worked is that it poisoned the whole ASP.NET, right? Because at that point, what was legit and what wasn't, right? So after a big hubbub with a lot of people at Novell and in high positions, we realized we got to start this from scratch, right? And essentially what we ended up doing is, because that employee at Novell that I contributed a lot of it very, very much legally and had done a great job, could not contribute to it anymore because he was tainted himself, right? By having looked at that source code. So what we did is basically set up a room with a table in the middle, and he would stand on one end and answer any questions, right? But would not be able to produce any code, and two other developers were facing him and basically coding away ASP.NET from scratch, asking him for details about how it worked, but never being able to get any source code and any contribution from him. And that's how the ASP.NET library got completely rewritten within Mono.
But then they end up getting bought by Microsoft and all the sins are forgiven.
I know, sins of the father. Go away, for sure.
That's good. Did you do anything else interesting there, like evangelizing or getting the Mono product out to folks?
Yeah. So, you know, being a product manager, you got to do a lot of interesting things. And depending on the software project you work in, you're going to be more of an internal or more on an external one, right? Often the product manager will be the person making the decision on what to prioritize, right? But Microsoft was kind of doing that for us already. We had to basically build a lot of what they were building, plus a few things that were Linux only or Mac only, but that was already kind of done, right? So a lot of my work was in internal and external evangelization, which was really interesting. So convincing people within Novell to start using Mono, which two or three projects did successfully, but also talking to the masses about Mono, right? To all the developers out there, especially in the Novell ecosystem. And in general, in the Linux ecosystem, which Novell was investing heavily in at the time. So I remember my fondest memory was the big, I think it was called BrainShare, if I recall correctly, the big Novell conference that happened every year. And I think the first one since these big acquisition in the Linux world, or at least once it had started bearing fruit, I got to organize and be on stage with Miguel, the founder of Mono, if you will, and giving a huge demo in front of, I think it was over 10, 12,000 people or so. That was really fun. I mean, building a demo targeted at developers with Miguel running around trying to reinvent the demo every 5 minutes, including 5 minutes before the demo had to take place itself, and even probably within the presentation itself. It was a great time. It was a lot of fun.
Well, all good things must come to an end. So eventually you move on to BuzzAgent?
Yeah. So at the time I decided it was great to be a product manager for these many years, but ultimately I wanted to get back to engineering, right? And looking back at what I thought were my experiences, my strength, I decided I wanted to get back to the early stages of engineering leadership, right? Got that opportunity at BuzzAgent, and I took on my kind of first role of what the industry sometimes calls repair CTO. And that usually happened when a company was in a kind of tipping point situation, right? Tipping point could have been a lot of different things. A simple decision to invest more in engineering and the software could be a round of funding, could be realizing maybe the CTO co-founder isn't either willing to move forward with being a real engineering leader or just can't do it, right? And in the case of BuzzAgent, Kurt was a great guy and a great developer, basically wanted to keep coding and solving tough issues and wanted nothing to do with growing an engineering team, managing it on the day-to-day, dealing with production, possible production issues, interacting with product, etc. All of the key tenets of early stage startup, right? And engineering team building. So I took that team over as an associate director of engineering, the associate director of engineering, eventually got to VP of engineering. And I remember that first day there, we had three developers around a big oak table near the harbor in Boston. And then I grew that team to something like 25 or so engineers. At the time, there were not a lot of DevOps. It was, you know, software engineers, QA engineers, DBAs, etc. But we moved to AWS probably about around 2007, 2008. And that was a great new change, great new set of technologies to learn about. And it was my first foray into real engineering leadership, which I didn't stop doing since then.
Thank you so much for joining this Zoom panel interview for our software development position. My apologies for having to reschedule it 7 times.
Hey, no worries. Ready to get this underway.
Let me introduce the panel members from our company. First is...
Whoever that is, can you please mute?
Sorry, that was me. Mailman's here.
Hey, you guys hear me? You see me? My kid is playing Fortnite and my bandwidth is sapped.
Hey, sorry, I was on mute. Hi, this is Connor Walton.
Can everyone who is not talking please mute yourself?
Sorry, so where were we?
Yeah, so the main reason I joined was to let you know that I accepted a job offer from your competitor this morning. Sorry, your process just took too long. Laters.
Does this drill sound all too familiar to you? If so, you should call Syrinx. Syrinx helps you complete your projects on time and on budget. So stop the Zoom calls and start shipping code today. Call us at 888-579-7469, option 1, or email us at sales@syrinx.com. That's sales@syrinx.com.
Now, how did you switch industries into the ad agency world after that?
Like some of my career in terms of the themes and the industry, it was not necessarily voluntary. It was more a great opportunity that I jumped on. It just so happened that, you know, BuzzAgent was marketing focused. So, you know, an ad agency or what Publicis is, which is one of the largest advertising holding companies in the world, was interested in that experience. And then the company after that was interested in the experience I had built, and suddenly I had a bit of a specialization in marketing, at least did 3 or 4 gigs focused on that. The reason I think Publicis hired me is that at the time they had decided to bring together all of the custom software that had been written by different agencies in their world and kind of put it together into a startup within that very large multinational company. And one of the problems they had is that they had 2 pieces of software that were very promising and built in France, right? And they basically thought, well, why not hire a French guy? He's going to be able to deal with that, right? And so I think I pretty much literally started that job and traveled to France that day. When you go back to the term repair CTO, which I think is an appropriate description in many cases, but seems a little pejorative, right? In this case, it was really repair CTO in that the software had been deployed a few weeks before I joined and had stopped working altogether. It was just dead in the mug. So came to France, worked with the developers there, and got the thing up and running again. So that was literally a repair job on the software on location. But it became a great opportunity. I had a couple of teams in France, 1 team in Boston, 1 team in Chicago, and it was my first foray into multi-time zone teams in different location. Even 1 developer there eventually decided to move to Lyon from Paris and became our first fully remote developer, which 11, 12 years later in the world that we live in seems pretty funny, but at the time was pretty avant-garde.
Maybe we should invent a new term. Maybe it's more of an evolution and transformation CTO than a repair CTO.
That sounds good. I like that.
So your next gig at NutraClick, how does that end up working out?
That was an interesting one. So from a technology perspective, it was really interesting. Got to build a lot of really interesting software. NutraClick was a very aggressive direct marketing company. It was called Hungryfish Media at the time. And For a year, it was great because I got to really focus on the software. And then as I kind of lifted my head a little bit away from the keyboard and the engineering team, I realized, wow, this is a company with no scruples in terms of how it treats the customer, right? And you live, you learn, right? And from then on, I really started looking much more into the business and the founders and what their culture is and what they're going to develop. So I left NeutralClick shortly thereafter. But yeah, that was a really interesting experience from a technology perspective, but also to learn how to recognize what the really good opportunities are and learn to see red flags.
So you consult for a while, kind of trying to figure out what you'd like to do next. Where do you end up landing eventually?
So I ended up at ConstContact, which, to be honest, I'd love to get credit for and how careful I was in choosing the opportunity. But I think I was even more lucky than I thought I was when I landed there. ConstContact had a great culture, great people, great software. It was a great company to work with. The big thing for me there was that for the first time, I reported to another engineering leader. So if you go back even to Talos in Russia, but after that to BuzzAgent, I reported to the COO or I reported to the CEO, and they were often kind of first-time startup people. They had no idea what to do in engineering. So I kind of learned on the job, right? And made mistakes and had some successes, but everything I kind of pieced together, right? But at ConstContact, I had a great engineering leader to look up to and a great mentor in him, but not only him, the VP of engineering, but also the CTO there was more focused on architecture type tasks. And I also had a great peer group of senior engineering leaders. So the other directors of engineering and eventually senior directors of engineering. And I learned a lot from both my mentors there and that group. So, you know, 3 years there, it was just an amazing learning opportunity. It was also the largest organization I got to manage, was given about 15 people, two smaller teams to start with, but grew that group to about 65 people or so over time, was given more product, more opportunities. And it was great. It was just a great opportunity. It's kind of too bad that, you know, the acquisition didn't pan out after that. It's changed a lot over time. That's what happens, the evolution of companies.
Is there anyone you'd like to thank or mention by name, that VP of engineering or CTO you liked working with?
Yes, Stephen Peach in the CTO, Mike Adler, the VP of engineering. But also everybody around me, Jim Early, I got along really well with, another director of engineering. But the whole group really was fantastic there. Not only engineering, but product and the rest of the business.
Excellent. Now from there, you become VP of engineering at Evertrue?
Yeah, Evertrue, great company, great mission to really help out with fundraising in higher education. Always a little alien in some ways because I wasn't the product of higher education in the US. So I was sometime looking a little bit from the outside, real repair CTO job as well, because it was probably the yuckiest tech that I ever had to deal with, right? You know, again, sins of the father, you inherit what people have done before, often in those roles, right? And the alternative is to ruin it yourself and start in a very small company, building everything yourself. But, you know, I remember something that at the time was very theoretical of saying, well, there are different tools for different jobs. Learn to figure out which one is the right one and use that one, right? But Evertrue was an environment where at the time, before I got there, the head of engineering had chosen to essentially with Cassandra, a SQL solution. And Evertrue had a very relational database type problem, right? So it was like everything screamed relational database, but they had Cassandra, right? And every problem we had at Evertrue was basically explained by, yeah, it's not a relational database. And what you're trying to do is very much what a relational database is really good at. And this is not. This is NoSQL database. So we kind of cloud ourselves back to MySQL there eventually.
Yeah, Cassandra's a great tool for the right problem, but for the wrong application, it's just trying to smash a square peg into a round hole.
Absolutely, yeah. And we used it at ConstContact, and it worked really well, but it was solving a very different problem there.
So you moved on to Validity. What did Validity do?
So validity is and was a roll-up. So its kind of raison d'être was to acquire companies in a given space, which was at the time data quality, and basically roll them out into a large product offering that, you know, when a customer was a customer of company A and we had bought A, B, and C, it would be natural that they'd be interested in B and C, right? So a lot of opportunities for integration of the three products, for upsell, so integration at the sales process level. And so validity was a fantastic opportunity because it was really the first time where I joined a company at the very beginning. I was, I think, employee 7 or something like that, and the first engineer hired. So I got to build a team from scratch, but also cheat along the way by making some very large acquisition, product, whole team, engineering team, et cetera. And, you know, it started with us acquiring a product which had essentially been built by one person and that another product that had been built by two other people, and essentially deciding, wow, this is great. We need to invest in this and we need to start building an engineering team. Second company that we bought with no engineers at all. It was basically, here's the software, here's the business. Good luck. Got to build an engineering team in a different tech stack, Ruby, this one, and kind of build up the product from then, right? Not only make it stable and performant, but start solving some tech debt and adding feature one after the other. And we continued doing that with acquisition number 3, number 4. Number 4 had something like, I think, over 600 employees, offices throughout the world. It was literally the frog eating the bull. And we suddenly went from, I think, 150 employees to 500 employees or so. And my team went from somewhere in the 30s to 100 people pretty much overnight, right? Unfortunately, we had to do layoffs. That was part of our investment thesis there, but it normalized and stabilized around 100. And at that point, you're dealing with, you know, 4 or 5 different tech stacks because you've done 4 or 5 acquisitions. It makes no sense to say, like, let's rewrite everything in one thing because, again, you know, best tool for the job, and the best tool for the job isn't the same tool for everybody. So it was really interesting to manage teams, lead teams that had different tech stack, different skill sets, different cultures, and try to start harmonizing all of that. And also occasionally different cloud providers, which is something we try to move away from and try to harmonize around AWS.
Yeah, it's always hard to sell management on a rewrite. Like, okay, you're going to spend a lot of money, you're going to get no new features, but it's going to work better and be more extensible. What do you say?
We were successful with one. So that first product we bought was written by one developer in Visual Basic, so VB.net and, you know, Windows.net. And we wanted this to be extensible and run on multiple platform and could be a web thing and et cetera. So we actually rebuilt this from scratch. And I'm happy to say that this was a big and long project and it got released pretty recently, which was a great achievement from Validity. A long project. We didn't really iterate through it, unfortunately, and we decided to just deliver 100% or 110% of the functionality. And that takes a while, but the result is really great.
So like a lot of folks, you know, the economy had some big changes over the last couple of years and there was some contraction. And I think that's when you moved on from there to FormAssembly.
It is. Yeah. Joined FormAssembly. I had talked to FormAssembly about a possible partnership while at Validity. So I was already in touch with Cedric there. Cedric is from France as well. So we had a quick, easy rapport from that perspective, though that didn't cut off an interview time in any way, of course. And found myself, yeah, a few weeks later at FormAssembly, which has been a blast, which has been a big difference between FormAssembly and a lot of companies out there today, is that FormAssembly's pretty much always been remote only. So as opposed to, say, Validity, which, you know, had some difficulties like everybody transitioning to this remote only culture with a real desire to go back to in office as soon as possible, there's no pressure at FormAssembly with any of that, right? So obviously, on a personal basis, we all suffer from the pandemic. We can ignore that. We've lost people. You know, I don't want to diminish it in any way. But from a professional point of view, at Form Assembly, we're not very affected because we didn't have to learn to be remote only. We were remote only. Our culture is remote only. Everything's been not adapted, but created to work in that fashion, right? And that's been working really well.
So what does Form Assembly do? Who's an ideal customer? What big problem does it solve for me?
So the way I think about it is it allows you to build complex data acquisition kind of business flows, right? In a way that does not require programming skills. So it is a no-code solution that allows anybody from creating complex forms. And very often IT has to kind of sign up on it when a customer wants to buy it. But very often our users are not actually IT professionals, let alone engineers. And we just are releasing very soon our workflow product. We just announced it today. And that will allow our customers to build even more complex multi-people workflows going back and forth between internal users, external applicants, and that sort of thing. So it's a really cool piece of software and very well written.
It seems to me like the sweet spot is, you know, you can't just get away with a Google form anymore. You need conditionals, you need logic, you have calculations. And at the end of this, you want that data to be pushed into a CRM like a Salesforce and create an account or a contact or an opportunity. That seems like the killer use case.
Absolutely. Yeah. When you look at Google Form, it's great for survey type tool, a quick throw it into a spreadsheet type thing. But with Form Assembly, the vast majority of our customers use Salesforce. So very often the forms are pre-filled with data coming from Salesforce, and they eventually are thrown back into Salesforce. So you could be filling a form, it creates an opportunity, it creates a contact, it creates a company, kind of binds them all together at the same time. It's a really powerful tool, especially for Salesforce users.
Now, you've been described sometimes by people that work for you as an engineer's engineering manager. Why would that be?
I think it's something that kind of started at the end of BuzzAgent, right? So when I was leaving BuzzAgent, after spending 4 years really learning on the job how to grow an engineering team, how to hire people, how to let go of some people, how to manage performance, how to manage a team, work with product management, etc., I had left coding behind me. I probably hadn't really coded in 4 years. And then I started interviewing. Everybody wanted someone who was coding every day at their job. I couldn't understand that. I said, but I'm interviewing for a VP of engineering role. Do you expect the VP of engineering to be coding? No. We don't expect them to be coding, but we want them to have coded just before. We want it to be fresh, right? And what I realized is that although I think I had developed a lot of really useful skills to this job, I had left behind something important, which was kind of my love for technology, but my everyday practice of technology, right? So it was a really good learning experience. And from that day, I decided I'm still going to code every day, no matter what, right? And most of the time, it doesn't happen at work, right? Because there's not a lot of time for that. But at home, I always code, right? Sometimes it's more of a DevOps type thing. But very often, it is me thinking, what do I need? Is there a niche I have to scratch? These days, it's been a lot of home automation stuff, some things around crypto and other topics. And then basically, I go, okay, great, I'm going to build that. What tech stack do I not know? And then I go and build it using that tech stack, if appropriate, right? So a lot of things like Laravel, like React, Golang, Angular, and many other things I've learned through that exercise. There's a project I'm considering taking on right now for myself. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's a big Elixir fan and decided, you know what, I'm going to build that in Elixir. That seems to be the right framework for this, and I'll get to learn this.
I think it's admirable. I think it's a great idea. I think a lot of people have a hard time walking the walk on that one, finding the time and grinding it out to like actually implement something using code when you're busy managing teams. But I think that that sentiment is popular amongst the hiring managers because we were helping someone recently. We knew a company looking for a CTO. We knew someone who had 20 years of experience of everything from a startup to like a huge company, was perfect for the job. And they're like, do you know Java? I'm like, is this relevant? But yeah, they really want to know, like, have you been touching some code recently?
Yeah. And that's only as important if you're going through the hiring process. I think it's important on day one as in your job, right? Because I think, you know, unless maybe you have 4,000 engineers, maybe it becomes less important. But I think in product management and engineering, you want people that have been, you know, an engineer or a product manager, but also retain a lot of these instincts, a lot of that knowledge, right? So when I heard people, I think it was at Cost Contact, describe me as an engineering leader, I think what they're alluding to is the fact that I can sit down, I can be a devil's advocate, I can be a sounding box, I can have an intelligent conversation with an engineer on what they're working on. Now, you know, I have no illusion. I don't understand every subtlety of everything. I can't go deep at this point. I can't really do code reviews on most code bases, but I can sit down with an engineer and have a good conversation. And they feel that their manager or their manager's manager, if that's what I am to them, isn't just a manager. They're still an engineer, right? And I think that's critical. That's important.
You're not just pushing around P&Ls on the Excel. You actually know how to code, and it becomes a tremendous credibility builder and what I'll call a snow melter. They can't snow you. They can't like say, oh yeah, we're going to need a left-handed smoke shifter and blah, blah, blah. No. I know how this works. This is how it's going to go. This is what you need to do. This is about how long it's going to take, and you can't be snowed.
Yeah, that allows you to build respect both ways, I think, right? That credibility is important.
Excellent. So Eric, thank you very much for coming down today and sharing your stories and experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It was a pleasure. It was a blast. Loved every minute of it.
Thank you. And we will talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.